From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to finance a movie. A talk with Jake Eberts, founder of the companies that produced Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, The Killing Fields, and Driving Miss Daisy. Also today, we meet two members of the Canadian comedy group, The Kids in the Hall. Ken Tucker examines the new traditionalism in country music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Jacob's Ladder. It's directed by Adrian Lyne, who also made Fatal Attraction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush denied today that his recent harsh rhetoric against Iraq is an alarm to prepare Americans for war in the Persian Gulf. The president told a news conference in Florida that he's really trying to point up his concerns about issues like the foreign hostages held in Iraq. He said that he's prepared to allow time for the UN sanctions against Iraq to work, but added that he's still not ruling out further options. On a Republican campaign trip today, the president suggested that Saddam Hussein was worse than Hitler in his use of foreign hostages as a human shield against attack. Amnesty International, the London-based human rights group, says that Saudi Arabia has detained and tortured hundreds of citizens of Yemen because of Yemen's support for Iraq in the Gulf crisis. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
In investigating human rights abuses in Yemen, Amnesty says it uncovered evidence of the abuse of up to 800 Yemeni citizens in Saudi Arabia. Amnesty investigators say they saw Yemenis recently who still had the marks of torture on their bodies. The victims were singled out apparently for no other reason, Amnesty charges, than their government has not sided with Saudi Arabia in the Gulf crisis. Yemen's government has opposed the U.S. deployment in the Gulf as well as the U.N. economic blockade of Iraq. Yemeni citizens in Saudi Arabia have been arrested in their homes and in schools, and there have been night raids into Yemeni neighborhoods in the city of Jeddah, according to the Amnesty report. The Saudi government told Amnesty it did not believe there has been widespread mistreatment of Yemenis in Saudi Arabia. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
The National Transportation Safety Board says the failure of a key engine part led to last year's crash landing of United Flight 232 in Sioux City, Iowa, an accident that claimed the lives of 112 people. 184 people did survive the crash landing. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
The safety board says a fan disc made from a faulty piece of metal set off the chain of events leading to the accident. The part failure led to an explosion in the tail engine, which shredded the plane's hydraulic systems, making it nearly impossible for the flight crew to control the DC-10. The safety board's chairman, James Colstead, says United and the engine manufacturer, GE, must share the blame for failing to discover the faulty part.
The primary cause of this accident was the failure of United to consider the human factors aspects in the inspection of fan disks. General Electric was the provider of this disk, and in fact, they provided a defective disk to begin with out of the factory.
The safety board did have praise for the United flight crew, which managed to land the plane by manipulating the two remaining engines. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Stock prices were moderately higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 2,455. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The celebrated films Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, Local Hero, and The Killing Fields were produced by the independent company Goldcrest Films. So were the box office bombs Revolution and Absolute Beginners. The company was founded in 1977 by Canadian financier Jake Eberts. He's co-authored a new book on the rise and fall of Goldcrest called My Indecision is Final. The collapse of Goldcrest was attributed in part to mismanagement after Eberts left the company over conflicts with another executive. In 1985, Eberts founded the company Allied Filmmakers, which produced Driving Miss Daisy, Texas Phil, and Kevin Costner's new film Dances with Wolves. Eberts lives most of the year in London, but he's currently in the States. We invited him to talk with us about the ins and outs of the business of film, such as what a company like his does.
Well, it does everything that a major studio does, except it doesn't distribute films. It develops films, it acquires rights to books, it gets ideas from filmmakers and turns those ideas into scripts. It gets projects ready so that they can be financed, so that we have a cast and a script and a director and a budget. Then we take that project, that package, to a major studio in the U.S. to get them to put up money to distribute the film in the U.S. market. As an example, on our most recent film, which is coming out in 10 days' time, Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, Kevin had been working on that idea for a number of years, and he had developed a screenplay based on a book which he had also worked on. And we got involved and put up about $500,000 to get the production going and get the budget written, get the final screenplay drafted, to prepare the whole package. We then took it to a number of studios, and Orion Pictures put in about $10 million, and we put up another $7.5 million, or almost $8 million. And with that $18 million, we said, "Okay, Kevin, off you go to South Dakota and start shooting." So that's the role of the film financier. It's a combination of picking projects, picking directors, picking writers, knowing how the various markets around the world look at projects and therefore how much they'll pay for those projects. Generally speaking, getting involved up to the time shooting starts and then standing back while the director and the crew make the film, and then stepping back in once the film is finished shooting and we then start to work on the edit and the music and finally start to work on the marketing, which is generally speaking about 6 or 8 months after shooting starts.
So one of the most important decisions you make is which films to back. Because if you back a loser, you're going to lose a lot of money. If you back a film that goes well at the box office, then you'll be very successful. Do you have criteria for making a decision like that? And I don't mean, you know, empirical criteria, but is it because you like a film that you'll say, let's produce it, or because you see box office possibilities in it?
I think there are two or three general rules which I tend to follow. Number one, I usually only get involved with a major filmmaker or with someone who's clearly got a overwhelming passion to make his film. That means either a director who has made several good or successful films. Good is not always the same as successful, because you can have a very good film which doesn't make money. But generally speaking, a director who's proven he really knows how to direct a film, number one. Number two, I only do it if I have a story or a script which I really like. It takes so much effort and so much time and so much devotion to the people involved that unless you feel this tremendous interest yourself, it just is impossible to generate the kind of enthusiasm and energy and effort that you need to get the whole thing done. So number two, I have to personally really like the story. And I think number three, I like to feel that the films we're making are suitable for my kids and my mother, so they have to appeal to the broadest possible demographic range from 11 years old and up to 78 years old. And that almost always means a film which is rooted in some sort of value system, which means it means something. It has more than just an action story or a brief topical story. It's a story which I think can last and can be reshown in 5 years' time or 10 years' time and still have the same impact as it would now.
Can I ask you for an example of one of the best and one of the worst choices you made in selecting a movie?
I can't give one of the best. I'll have to plead and say, let me give you two or three of the best and two or three of the worst.
Okay.
Certainly among the best would be Chariots of Fire, which we made in 1981. Gandhi, which we made in 82, Killing Fields, which we made in 83. Those, I think, are among the best. Driving Miss Daisy, which we made about 18 months ago. All those films have the same ingredients which I mentioned earlier, a great filmmaker attached, either as director or producer, a story which I felt I really wanted to see made. I think all those films can be looked at in 5 or 10 years' time and have the same impact and have the same meaning and perhaps give the same kind of enjoyment as they did when they first came out. Among the worst films which I ever got involved in, one was called Zulu Dawn, which I did in the late 70s, where I, for the first and last time, put up my own money, which was an awful mistake, which I lost all of. the film was not made by a good filmmaker. I wasn't deeply involved with the story. I did it for all the wrong reasons. I did it to make money, which I didn't. I lost money on it. So that would certainly have to be up there amongst the worst films I got involved in. Going on from there, I guess I'd have to choose a film called An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, which was a small film I made for all the wrong reasons in 1981. Again, the deal was a good deal, but the film was a terrible film. The deal was good because we had some tax benefits, and the minute you start making films because the deal is good, you're probably guaranteeing that you're going to lose money, and I did, at least our company did. Moving on swiftly, this is painful. It's hard to choose the worst. I guess I can say we made two bad films and hopefully many more good ones. But those two stick out in my mind as bad mistakes. And now that I know why I made them, I can look back and say I made them for the wrong reasons and hope I never do that sort of thing again. I'm too old for it.
You say when you make a movie because the deal sounds good, the movie almost always goes bad. I don't think that that's a given in most of Hollywood, do you?
Well, it's frequently a given. I think that when you talk about independent films, which are the films I make, which are then taken to a major studio for part financing and for distribution, the deal is clearly an overwhelming part of the transaction. We don't often have unlimited funds. We don't often have a major star, although sometimes we do. We are dealing with tight budgets, difficult locations, usually things which are hard to explain, hard to conceptualize. So we're not focusing so much on the deal. In Hollywood, the deal is paramount because money isn't the problem. Every major studio has far more money than they have projects to spend that money on. Money is not the problem. They have money to spend on the project, on the star, on the promotion of the picture. The last problem is, where do they get the money from? The biggest problem is, how good is the deal, and can they find the right kind of project to work on? So the deal becomes far more important in Hollywood, and often the deal is done without any attention being paid to the script, without any attention being paid to the integrity of the project. It's basically, who is the star, how much is he worth, what sort of impact will he have on the marquee, can we get Arnold Schwarzenegger, can we get Sylvester Stallone, can we get whoever it is who's hot at the time, and let's not worry too much about the budget or the script right now. Let's get the deal done first. I think it is an overwhelming part of the Hollywood system, which is regrettable.
Do you pre-sell films? And if you do, I'm going to ask you to describe what pre-selling is.
Yes, I do. And pre-selling simply is taking the project which we've designed, which has a script and a cast and a budget and a director and a producer, and going to a distributor, either in the U.S. or, in many cases, individual foreign countries, and getting him to agree to put up X amount of money, which is payable to us when we deliver the film. So we've pre-sold the rights to the extent that he doesn't see the film before he buys it. He sees the project. He sees the proposal and buys it basically because he believes in the script and the talents of the filmmakers involved and that he thinks the terms are fair. And he pre-buys it and pays us once the film is finished and delivered. I then take the contract, which he signs, which is a promise to pay on delivery, and go to a bank, and the bank then lends me money against that promise. I then have the money to make the movie, and when the film is delivered, the person who signed the contract pays me. I then pay back the bank, and hopefully there's a bit of a margin. We make a profit. That's what pre-selling is.
Now, I think it's largely because of pre-selling that there's something called high concept, which is where you pre-sell a movie based on two or three lines that explains what the movie is. Give us an example of a high concept sales pitch.
Well, a high concept sales pitch, I think, can be best exemplified by taking a complicated film and then trying to reduce that film to a few words, or the story to a few words. We got involved some years ago with a wonderful film with Sean Connery called The Name of the Rose, which was based on a best-selling book by Umberto Eco. Best-selling book is probably a bit of a misnomer because it's probably the greatest unread bestseller in the history of publishing.
Right.
Everyone bought it, but no one could read it. I bought it. I struggled through it. I had a terrible time reading it, but I loved it. I just found it very hard to read. Frankly, I didn't get through it the first time. I then had to go back and read it when I finally got involved with the film. But that is a very complex tale with all sorts of side tales and red herrings and philosophical conversations about Christianity and about the Inquisition and about the place of man on Earth, and it's a very complex book. But when I came to sell the idea, I had to reduce all that mass of 680 pages into a 2 or 3 sentence sales pitch to Hollywood. So I said, this is a story about a murder in a medieval monastery starring Sean Connery. That was it. And on that basis, we were able to raise almost $17 million. Now, Sean's name, of course, helped somewhat, although in those days he wasn't quite as big a star as he is now. He had been mainly known for his James Bond roles and hadn't been really all that successful in non-James Bond roles. And I'd known him for some time. I was a great admirer of him, and I thought he was a wonderful fellow to work with. He's a wonderfully friendly man and someone that you can get along with very well, although he's very demanding. And so we weren't selling Sean because he was a major star. We were selling Sean because he was a fine actor, and I felt that if he could perform the way I thought he could in this film, he'd break out of the James Bond mold and become much better known for non-James Bond roles. And as it turned out, that happened, and it was sold on the high concept basis, helped by Sean's name, but it was a concept. Murder mystery always sounds good to a buyer.
My guest is Jake Eberts, and he's in the film financing business. He founded the company Goldcrest Films, which produced Gandhi, Local Hero, Chariots of Fire, and The Killing Fields. And now he's the chief executive of Allied Films, which recently produced Driving Miss Daisy. He's written a new book about the movie business and about the rise and fall of Goldcrest Films. It's called My Indecision is Final. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Jake Eberts is my guest, and we're talking about the financing of movies, and it's the subject of his new book, My Indecision is Final. I'm interested in how you put a package together. Let's start at the beginning. When after you've bought the rights to a movie, and you're looking for a funding package, who do you approach first? Do you go, who are the financiers? I don't mean to name names, but what kinds of potential financiers do you typically approach to make a movie?
Oh, I'll name names if you like.
Sure.
First of all, we have to separate the financing into several different categories. And the first is the development phase, which is what I do myself. I put our own money, my own company's money goes into that phase. And that normally is in the range of $250,000 to a maximum of $1.5 million. And it's very, very risky investment because you're buying nothing more than an idea. Even if the idea is from a best-selling book, it's a complicated, difficult, and lengthy task to convert that idea into a screenplay and then finally to get the package together. Now, let me give you a case in point. City of Joy, which was a very, very successful book published 5 years ago, written by a man called Dominique Lapierre. Mm-hmm. And it was a story about a priest and a doctor in a slum in Calcutta, not the obvious choice for a major feature film. But it had the most extraordinarily uplifting qualities and the most moving and heart-rending scenes that when I read the book, I rang up the author and took an option on the film rights by telephone, and I paid at the time $100,000 to get that option against a final price of $350,000. So I put down, if you wish, had a down payment of $100,000. And if the film was ever made, I'd have to pay him a further $250,000. See, I've named names and given you actual figures here. I then took the idea to Roland Joffe, who I had known because he had been the director of The Killing Fields, which was a very successful film that we had done together in 1982. And Roland had, as it happened, read the book and knew the idea and was very interested in getting involved. So I had then an option on the book for which I'd paid $100,000. I then had a director who was very well known and very talented. We then searched around for a writer, and we came across Mark Medoff, who had written the screenplay for Children of a Lesser God. He'd also written the stage play and was adept at taking stories and plays and turning them into screenplays. And we, then hired Mark, and we paid him a sum, which I don't need to disclose in quite as much detail, but a sum of money, which was once again on account of an additional payment which he would receive if the film was ever made. And we have then, since that time, we have spent 5 years working on the project.
Oh, so you don't have the money for it yet to...
Now
to
we
really
do.
Start. Now, it's,
now we do. We're actually in pre-production. We've been in pre-production now for about a week. And we start shooting in Calcutta on the 4th of February, 1991. And I bought the rights originally in September of 1986. So it's 5 years, or it'll be almost 5 years from the time we bought the rights to the time the film is actually finished.
So how do you raise the money, enough money, to start working on a movie? You try to sell the foreign rights?
Yes, I put up all the front-end money. And I put up a substantial amount of money against the future sale of the foreign rights. If you wish, I pre-buy my own foreign rights. I look at the foreign markets and I say, all right, in the case of City of Joy, which is a very, very expensive film, it's going to cost about $27 million, I think that I can sell the foreign rights in the various territories that I'm familiar with for around $15 or $16 million, which is a very high number. It's higher than most... films of this nature, because Roland Joffé is very well known in the foreign markets, and this kind of story appeals a lot in certain foreign markets, mainly France, Italy, Spain, Japan, Germany, and the UK. So I can estimate that I can probably do about $15-16 million of sales in the foreign markets. And since the film's going to cost about $27 million, I've got to raise another $10-12 million from the US. So I take the package, which consists of a finished script, and Roland Joffé as director. I'm actually producing this one myself. And I go around Hollywood and call on all the major studios, and I try and get them to put up $12 million against the U.S. rights. And I get turned down by most people. That's standard. Finally, I got TriStar to put the money up. TriStar is now part of a major film company conglomerate owned by Sony. And TriStar have come along for the roughly $10 million, which I needed to fill the gap in. I don't actually raise money from private investors or from venture capital funds. I raise money really only from distributors of the film. I don't ask anyone else to get involved, because it's a very risky business and it's very hard to explain how the business works. And it makes much more sense to me to be selling film rights to people who are experienced in buying film rights and distributing films, and letting them make their own judgment about whether the film is good, bad, or indifferent. And if it succeeds, they have a profit share, and they make more money on the back end. And if it fails, well, they take a write-off, and they're going to be much more wary next time I come to see them. But they've been lucky with our films. Over the years, they've done very well with 6 or 7 of our films, and they haven't lost a lot on 4 or 5 others. So it's been a good relationship. But that's how the deal is put together.
Even though you work with a distributor who distributes the movies, you don't distribute them yourselves, I know that you'll be able to fill us in a little bit on how film distribution works. Most of the movie theaters now are owned by large chains, which, with the exception of repertories and art houses. How are movies distributed to chains? How is it? What's the bidding process like?
Well, it's open bidding in most states, not all states, but in most states, the film is shown in its finished form or almost finished form, and the theaters then bid on the film. They offer certain amounts of money as guarantees in certain terms. Typically, the theater owner, who is called an exhibitor, would pay to the distributor, in this case, let's say Warner Brothers, in the first week that the film is on release and being shown in the theater, the exhibitor will pay the distributor roughly 90% of the box office take after the exhibitor has paid his own overhead costs. In subsequent weeks, the percentage which the exhibitor pays over to the distributor decreases, so that he keeps more and more as the box office tends to go down. The main source of revenue for the exhibitor, for the theater owner, is in fact Coca-Cola and popcorn. He makes more money by selling Coca-Cola and popcorn than he makes on the ticket sale. The distributor, the funds which he received are used, first of all, to pay for the advertising and promotion of the film, which incidentally can sometimes exceed the cost of making the film. It's not unusual to spend $15 million to promote and advertise a $10 million movie. So the bulk of the money which is received by the distributor goes to pay the advertising and promotion of the film. The real profit comes once the film is finished its run in the theater, then it's sold into the video market, and ultimately into the pay television and the television markets. And most of the profit that you get from feature films comes in the video and the television markets and not from the box office.
The American economy doesn't seem to be doing that well. No, I mean, no matter what the figures officially show now, most Americans are pretty convinced that there's a recession going on. And there's a possible war on the horizon. I wonder how these things are affecting the financing of movies.
Well, the movie business is not totally recession-proof, but it's as close as you can get to it. There is almost no evidence that there's a slowing down in the public's demand for good movies, and that applies to the exhibition of those movies in theaters or video sales or pay television sales or even network sales. The conventional wisdom is that when times are bad, people seek entertainment even more, so they tend to go to more movies or they tend to buy more videos. It's clear that the cost of capital, which is sometimes driven up by this sort of thing, or indeed it's clear that in certain markets they might be less inclined to take a risk because the general feeling of pessimism sets in. But the effect is not very noticeable. It's really quite marginal, and I haven't actually seen it yet. But I'm bound to see it to a certain extent, but not much.
What about the possibility of war? Are people in the movie business afraid to spend their money now?
The tragic thing about the film business is that the people who are involved in it have almost no idea what's going on outside the film business. One reason why I don't live in Hollywood, one reason why I live in London, England, and spend a lot of my time up in Canada, is because I find it so stifling and so limiting to live in an environment which is totally devoted to movies, and it's an unfortunate a reflection on the way the industry operates that the impact of short, medium, and long-term problems is almost without any recognition. And although I pick up the paper every day and scan it anxiously for what's happening in the Middle East, and I carefully tune in on CNN and listen to NPR because it's a great source of news, I think that people who are deeply involved in the business in Hollywood just don't have time for it or don't have the interest in doing it, and they're reading tends to be limited to looking at scripts and reading what's called the trades, which are daily issues of a Variety or the Hollywood Reporter, which tells them what's going on in the business. It doesn't seem to have any impact whatsoever.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about movies. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been film executive Jake Eberts. His new book is called My Indecision Is Final, The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Goldcrest Films, the independent studio that challenged Hollywood. Next time, Jeffrey Mason. He once was a member of the Freudian Inner Circle and served as project director of the Freud Archives. But then he turned against Freud's theories and psychoanalysis. He has a new book called Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker examines country music's new traditionalist movement and where country stars Garth Brooks and Roseanne Cash fit in. Also, we meet two members of the Kids in the Hall. They're a Canadian comedy group of five men, four straight, one gay. Each can play a woman when the sketch requires it, and some of the sketches are pretty gender-bending. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new psychological thriller, Jacob's Ladder. It's from the director of Fatal Attraction, and it stars Tim Robbins as a Vietnam veteran who may be losing his mind or may be the victim of a conspiracy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush continued his strong criticism of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein as he said that he was more barbaric than Hitler, and the president is more determined than ever to drive him out of Kuwait. Campaigning today for Republican candidates, Mr. Bush said that he still planned to give U.N. sanctions time to work. The White House says the tough talk is designed to prepare the country for any occurrence and that the military option has not been ruled out. In New York City at the U.N., the Secretary General has issued a report on the violence that occurred last month at Jerusalem's Temple Mount. Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
Security Council members are studying the 1949 Geneva Convention to decide whether they should take up the Secretary General's suggestion that they might call a meeting of the convention's 162 signatories. The convention sets out international rules for the treatment of those living in occupied territories. The UN leader made a suggestion because of Israel's lack of cooperation with United Nations requests for safeguarding the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So far, Israel's reaction has been negative, and it's unlikely they would attend such a meeting. U.S. sources here say it will take several days to determine how useful such a conference could be and have not yet decided whether to support the idea. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
In El Salvador, the top leftist rebel commander has issued a thinly veiled threat to boycott legislative elections next March as peace talks with the government remain deadlocked. From San Salvador, Tom Gibb reports.
The statement is signed by top rebel commander Joaquim Villalobos. He says that under present conditions, elections would only serve to legitimize the government and the military. He says international supervision alone will not provide any guarantee of long-term safety for leftist parties. Earlier this year, the guerrillas were talking about participating in the elections, at least indirectly. The apparent change of mind comes after United Nations-sponsored peace talks have deadlocked over rebel demands for a fundamental restructuring of the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military. The statement comes less than 2 weeks after the U.S. Congress, angered by continuing army human rights abuses, cut 50% of military aid to El Salvador. The two sides are due to meet again this month in Mexico. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
The Labor Department says that claims for weekly unemployment benefits moved up strongly in mid-October to their highest point since May of 1983. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 13 points to close at 2,454.95, volume 160 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
Hey, she's my lady luck. Hey, I'm her wild card man. Together we're building up a real hot hand. We live out in the country. Hey, she's my little queen of the south. Yeah, we're two of a kind, working on a full house.
That's country singer Garth Brooks, who picked up two Country Music Association awards last month. Album of the Year for his debut album, and the Horizon Award given to newcomers. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Brooks' new album and a new album from singer and songwriter Roseanne Cash.
A few years ago, the most heartening development in country music was what came to be called the New Traditionalist Movement. Young singers like Randy Travis, Dwight Yoakam, and George Strait came along and pulled country music back to its roots, by rejecting pop melodies and rock instrumentation. In what amounted to a kind of country nationalism, the new traditionalists proudly asserted the twangs in their voices and emphasized the plaintive whines of fiddles and pedal steel guitars, instruments that symbolized everything that was corny, passionate, and sincere about country music. Garth Brooks is the latest of the new traditionalists to hit it big, and his new single is the agreeably goofy Friends in Low Places.
Blame it all on my roots. I showed up in boots and ruined your black tie affair. The last one to know, the last one to show, I was the last one you thought you'd see there. And I saw the surprise and the fear in his eyes when I took his glass of champagne. I toasted you, said, honey, we may be through, but you'll never hear me complain. 'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases my blues away. And I'll be okay.
Garth Brooks' second album, No Fences, is the best-selling country album in America right now. And this young, moon-faced crooner has done what most people thought was impossible. He's made a traditionalist record that's crossed over. No Fences is nudging into the top 10 on the pop charts. Country albums haven't done this sort of thing since that phony baloney urban cowboy craze in 1980. I guess I should be pleased, but I find Garth Brooks bothersome. For a young newcomer, he already sounds rather complacent. There's something slack in his delivery, and for a new traditionalist, he often moans suspiciously like a folk singer.
Charlie Barton and his family stopped today to say goodbye. They said the bank was taking over. The last few years were just too dry. And I promised that I'd visit when they found a place in town. Then I spent a long time thinking about the ones the wolves pulled down.
The problem with being part of any movement, even a theoretically rebellious one, is that if you do anything different, you're no longer part of the team. A couple of years ago, it was possible to listen to the hits of Roseanne Cash and still consider her a new traditionalist. On her new album, Interiors, however, she's trying for a more personal, idiosyncratic style.
Crawled night and day, tears and debris. Now I'm reaching out to you, but I'm keeping my hands clean. Tables are turning, the tempo slows down. We're getting off of this misery go-round. Brand new world, baby, now things have changed. Brand new picture in a brand new frame. A turn of the page with the blink of your eye. Our two steps in rhythm, our hearts beat in time. On the inside, it all happened on the inside. It all went down on the inside.
Garth Brooks breaks up his sad songs with brisk little up-tempo tunes. But Roseanne Cash has bravely decided to make Interiors an all-out bummer. She's written and produced almost every song on this album, and it forms a litany of infidelity, depression, and despair. Like the Woody Allen movie that shares the same title, Interiors is beautifully crafted and terribly humorless.
I picked up the phone, we were both on the line. Your words to each other froze me in time. A lifetime between us just burned on the wires. Dissolved in a dial tone, consumed in your fires. Your footsteps beside me, the phone in my hand. I can't move.
As much of a drag as it is, Interiors is an admirable record. Unlike Garth Brooks's commercial breakthrough, though, I don't hear any hits on this one. Cash used to make her heartbreak hummable and catchy on songs like 7 Year Ache and I Don't Know Why You Don't Want Me. Just as Garth Brooks is reaching out to a mass audience, Roseanne Cash seems to be resigning herself to a cult.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Now you read a lot of things in the daily news, but I'm laying awake at night wondering what to do. I pray the Lord our souls to keep us all down here fast asleep. I want to say this will be.
This is Fresh Air. The Kids in the Hall is a group of five Canadians in their late 20s and early 30s who write and perform sketch comedy. Lorne Michaels, the creator of Saturday Night Live, first saw the kids perform in Toronto in 1986 and took them under his wing. He's the executive producer of their HBO series, which is in its second season. The members of this all-male group write some pretty gender-bending humor. My guests are Mark McKinney and Scott Thompson. This sketch, conceived by McKinney, is about a group of guys playing poker.
My deal?
Yeah.
So are you in or out of this one? I want more of your money.
Just give me a minute.
Come on, are you in or out?
Just give me a minute.
Are you in
or
out?
Would you just give me a minute?
Whoa, what's wrong with you, having your period?
Well, what if I was, huh?
Do you want to step outside?
Hey. No. I just want to have a period, that's all. Just one a month, okay?
Come on, guys.
Why? Might help a guy organize his time.
Yeah. Each month, I feel my body become fertile, and I'd say, no, I choose not to have a baby. Oh, rent's due.
Yeah. Well, that'd be pretty ridiculous, you know, because I hear menopause is ugly.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yes.
I heard it's great.
What?
Yeah, I hear it's like taking ecstasy in a rocket ship ride, all rolled into one.
What?
Hey, my husband. And I hear that you don't know
well,
what you're talking about.
Well, we will never know, will we?
Deal.
Mark, would you explain where the title Kids in the Hall comes from?
The title Kids in the Hall comes from a Jack Benny history, from the history of Jack Benny. He had comedy writers that he would pass in the hallway on the way to his radio show, and they would try and sell him jokes for $5-$10 a piece. And if it worked on the air, he would say, that's one from the Kids in the Hall. And then eventually, as Jack Benny aged, so did the Kids in the Hall. But they were a very old man.
Did you guys ever get confused with New Kids on the Block?
Constantly.
It's awful. I watched their rise up the chart.
Constantly.
We're called, more often than not, it's now the New Kids in the Hall or the...
Yeah. But, yeah, apparently I'm the gay one. And I don't know which New Kid in the Block that would be, but... I'm not saying anything, but...
Let me ask you to each describe one or two characters that you've created.
Mark, you start.
Me? Oh, okay. Well, I suppose the best-known one is this guy who sits in a park in a chair and just takes out his misanthropy, is that the right word, on the world
mm-hmm.
by crushing the heads of people, squinting through his thumb and forefinger and pinching off their heads.
He's imagining he's pinching them off.
Well, given his tenuous grasp on reality of this particular character, he might believe it actually is happening.
Scott, describe one or two characters that you've done.
One character I do is called Buddy Cole. And he's a lounge lizard, like a philosopher queen who basically is glued to a bar chair in a gay bar. And all he basically does is drink, watch the passing parade, and comment acidly about it. And he's based on a number of queens that I've known, and the queen in me.
People make fun of me because I lisp. Really? Such a lot of fuss over a few extra S's. They say that every different group has their own language. For example, fags say things like girl and sister and what's her problem. Another example, foxy black mamas. They say things like girl and sister and what's her problem. Makes you think.
Is it ever problematical to do a queen without feeling like that you're furthering certain stereotypes that people have of gays?
Yes, actually, at the beginning, I did question it a lot. Now I don't, because I think that it's basically people that think I'm reinforcing a stereotype are operating from a flawed beginning, because to say that that's reinforcing a negative stereotype would be to say that effeminacy or femininity is negative. And when you don't believe that is negative, even in a man, then you're okay. Plus, as well, I believe that Buddy's always a winner, and he's smarter than anyone around him, and people don't laugh at him, they're laughing at what he says. He's not a loser, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's not like all the queens that have come before in pop culture.
Wait a minute. Buddy is gay?
No, he's not gay, Mark. He's just... He's only accepted by the gay community, but he's completely heterosexual.
Oh,
he has three children and a lovely wife. But
terrific. Good.
He's just
I don't know. I just heard something there. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay.
All of the performers in Kids in the Hall have dressed in drag at some point to play women. And I have to say, I think you all do it in a very convincing way. It's not this real broad Milton Berle kind of burlesque of women. The first time I saw one of those sketches, I thought it was a woman. What's the key to being a man and playing a woman convincingly?
Well, it all started off, we started playing women because we were, you know, we all had relationships. And after a while, when we started writing sketch comedy, writing scenes about just the five of us or some skewed reality just wasn't playing off. So we thought we'd write about our girlfriends and our mothers and our sisters and our, we don't have any daughters, do we? No. So we just thought we will do it accurately. We're not going to get laughs for being a guy in a dress. And sorry, the other part of your question was, it was sort of a two-parter there.
Oh, how do you make it convincing?
How do you make it convincing? Well, just by playing it completely straight. You try as an actor to observe as much as you can about the character that you're doing, comedically, of course. But you never, ever get a laugh on the basis that, you know.
Unless it's a funny-looking woman. Do you know what I mean? I mean, unless she's supposed to be funny looking.
Yeah, but beyond that, you're still saying this is a real character.
Did you ever consider, instead of having the men play female parts, actually casting women, actually adding women to the group?
We did. In the early part, women came in and out of the group, but it's a sort of a sad reality because there are fewer women in comedy that if they're good, they tend to accelerate a lot quicker. And we had 2.5 years in the wilderness playing to 8 people once a week, where it was very, very tough. We were making absolutely no money, and the women who stuck with us for a little while and who became good got swallowed up by Second City or got commercial work or
became stand-ups like Sandra.
Yeah.
Scott, you are known as the gay member of the group.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I was known as the pretty member or the really hung guy. But no, I have this.
Were you always out in your career as an actor or comic?
No, I was not. I came out actually very late. I came out when I was 24. And
how many years ago was that?
8.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
But I came out with a vengeance, I guess, and I just never thought, there just didn't seem to be any point in doing comedy that came from yourself and being in the closet. It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, and yet I know that there are literally hundreds of people out there who are doing it in popular culture, and many of them, you know what I mean? Comedians and writers and actors, and I don't know how they do it, and I wouldn't want to have to do that, but it just made sense to me. But with the Kids in the Hall, I was out from day one on stage, yes.
And they never had any problem with it?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. And but, you know, they, everybody does, you know? I mean, everybody's got internalized homophobia, even me. So,
yeah, but you really got to stop this fag bashing stuff. That's taking it too far.
Yeah. We're a group that's very dedicated to each other, and we've worked all of our problems out, and it's, we just accept each other for what everybody is, you know?
You mentioned one of the gay characters that you've created, the queen. Is there another one that you could describe?
Big gay character? I have some gay personas that aren't as developed as Buddy, and I've played other characters who are gay that have
Tony Baldwin.
Yeah, Tony Ball. I have one this year. He's actually a television star, and he's very much like those primetime
hunks.
He's
on a show called Surf Cops.
Yeah, and you know, yo, my name's Tony Baldwin. And
pen your book.
Yeah, you know, he's really macho, and he's a sex symbol, and he's on television, and he wants to be a movie star.
And he's trying to keep his stories out of the Inquirer.
And he's terrified because of what's happening in popular culture that he's going to be outed. And I won't say who he's based on or anything like that because I don't really know, because there's, God knows, there's many out there to choose from. And he's just this really kind of, I think, pathetic person who can't accept himself.
But comic.
But he's funny. But at the same time, he's one of those gays in popular culture who define masculinity, which is that strange thing we have.
Yeah, yeah. I think Kids in the Hall is inevitably compared to SCTV because both groups are originally from Canada. Do you feel any connection with SCTV besides the Canadian one?
Actually, I do feel real connection with them because I think we are part of a lineage in terms of, like, I think like In Living Color is sort of like the new Saturday Night Live. And I think maybe you could say we are like an SCTV because when Saturday Night Live was around, they were huge. You know, it was a major phenomenon. And SCTV was lesser so. Do you know what I mean? They were making their kind of comedy. It was more cultish. And mm-hmm. I think we're more cultish than In Living Color is. And I mean, I think it's harder to find us because we are on cable and all that. And I think that we have a very similar outsider stance that SCTV has. We look at things from the outside because we are non-Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark McKinney and Scott Thompson from the comedy group The Kids in the Hall. Their second season on HBO begins next month. Last season shows are on the Comedy Channel. Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what kind of political campaigning stories do you have for us today?
Terry, the campaign is getting closer and in lots of parts of the country getting hotter. In North Carolina, the Republican candidate, Senator Jesse Helms, has launched some ads, which are controversial. We will be looking at the woman who is likely to be the mayor of D.C. to replace Mayor Marion Barry at the nation's capital. And in Rhode Island, there's a Senate race, Senator Claiborne Pell, the Democrat, against a Republican Congresswoman, Claudine Schneiders. We'll be taking a look at all those races and at President Bush, who is out on the campaign trail again today and still sounding belligerent.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jacob's Ladder is a new movie that opens this week, directed by Adrian Lyne, whose last movie was the very popular Fatal Attraction. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
At the movies, things we might otherwise find unpleasant can suddenly seem like fun. Fear, for instance, and hopeless longing and shock. Root canal work, however, is not exactly what I want with my popcorn, and that's what Jacob's Ladder provides. This is a crazed Nazi dentist of a movie, drilling at your nerves until they bleed. Its hero is Jacob Singer, played by Tim Robbins. He's just your normal, everyday Vietnam vet mailman with a PhD in philosophy and a pretty bad tendency to hallucinate. Mostly, he hallucinates things trying to run him over, subway trains, for instance. And he also conjures up a lot of lizard tails and weird, staring people whose heads suddenly start vibrating like a tuning fork. Sometimes he hallucinates that his whole life is a hallucination, including his hellish Brooklyn apartment and his sexy girlfriend, who's played by Elizabeth Peña and is all too significantly named Jezebel. At times, he imagines he's still with his wonderful first wife and his wonderful kids, only to wake up a moment later to find himself in a bathtub full of ice water, or in a hospital bed having a conversation like this one with his doctor.
Get me out of here.
Where do you want to go?
Home.
Home? This is your home. You're dead.
Dead? No. Oh, I just hurt my back. I'm not dead.
What are you then?
I'm alive.
Then what are you doing here? What is happening?
Get me out of here.
There is no out of here.
You said it, pal. There is no out of here. Not with director Adrian Lyne drilling away at your skull. It's not that Lyne's horrific images are so hard to take. They're inspired by artists like Francis Bacon, William Blake, and Diane Arbus. No, the problem is that Lyne cheats. He uses strobe lights on us and subliminal flashes of things, and he gives explanations that pretend to make sense but don't. He keeps betraying us and changing the rules. The worst part is that this movie is deadly serious. It wants to teach and admonish. It wants to, as they say in Hollywood, make us think. The writer, Bruce Joel Rubin, who gave us the summer's big hit, Ghost, has said he was trying to, quote, find the essence of fear, not to indulge in some capricious experience, but to shake up the audience for a reason. But what reason? The film builds to a big explanation of Jacob's hallucinations that has to do with American malfeasance in Vietnam, but it's all such contrived nonsense that you can't buy it for a second, besides which it doesn't begin to explain anything that happens to Jacob. The acting isn't the point here, of course, but most of it is good, and Tim Robbins has a likably rubbery adolescent face and boyish grin. He goes a long way toward making you think that this movie is actually about a person instead of about a series of razzle-dazzle editing tricks. Jacob's Ladder, though, is dangerous. It should be rated NHCO. No one admitted with a headache coming on.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Audrey Vablitis, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeffrey Mason, the former head of the Freud Archives, tells us why he now opposes Freudian analysis as well as all other forms of psychotherapy. And we meet comic book artists Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez, creators of Love and Rockets. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.